Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
If someone were afraid of the dentist, maybe they haven't been in a long time, maybe they're embarrassed because they haven't been in a while, I feel like this would be a really safe place for them to go and get the care that they need.
At Advanced Dentistry, we get it. If you've been avoiding the dentist because of fear, worry, or just not wanting to be judged, if you want to learn how IV sedation can change your life, visit nofeardentist.com.
Hey, everybody. This is a fun one, a fun episode of the Three Questions, because I'm talking to a real newsman. Chris Hayes from MSNBC has been good enough to do this podcast, and he's got to go be a news guy in like five minutes.
A newsman.
Yeah, a newsman. A newsman. How are you?
I'm good, Andy. How are you, man?
I'm good. Do you call yourself journalist? Do you call yourself TV host?
It's funny. I say, when people ask me what I do, I say I'm a reporter, which is, I sort of think the way I still think about myself.
Yeah.
I say I'm a reporter, or a journalist. That's how I still think of myself. I still do a lot of, you know, I still spend a lot of time like texting and talking to sources and, trying to, you know, I think the thing that I loved that I fell in love with about reporting right out of college was, it seemed like this incredible hustle where you could learn professionally and people would pay you to learn, as opposed to going to grad school, which was paying to learn.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wait, there's a way to, like, rather than pay to learn, what if people paid me to learn?
Right.
And I feel like I've somehow managed to basically keep that going, to get paid to learn.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the same thing in like the performing that I do. It take all the classes you want, but until you're actually on a stage in front of dispassionate drunks, you don't know what you're doing. You know, the rubber is not meeting the road. But you were born into a journalisty family, right? Your dad's a reporter. Yeah.
No, my dad's, I mean, I was born into a very political family, but my dad was a Jesuit seminarian.
So on his way to being a priest.
Yes, in fact, had gone. So back in the day, they don't do this as much anymore. But he'd gone to a Jesuit high school, St. Ignatius, in the North Shore of Chicago. He was from the city of Chicago, and then he had immediately out of high school, at like the age of 18, went and entered the seminary, and sort of moved around because the Jesuits would sort of move their cohorts around, and he was in Detroit, he was in Xavier, he was in Peru, and then he ended up...
Seems shady, to be honest, exactly. Moving people around like that.
Yeah, maybe they were up to something I didn't realize, but he ended up in the Bronx at Fordham, and his sort of small group of Jesuits got an apartment in an apartment building in the kind of South Bronx near Fordham that happened to be the apartment building that my mother had grown up in and was living in, mm-hmm. While going to leaving college in the Bronx. And so they met as neighbors, and then eventually fell in love. He left the seminary. My mom became a teacher. My dad became a community organizer. And he'd already started doing this kind of community organizing as a Jesuit. So it was a sort of natural transition. But they stayed in the Bronx. My mom taught in the Bronx, and he did community organizing in the Bronx.
And your mom's Italian, right? Because that explains your crazy middle name.
I know. People are always so weirdly surprised by my middle name, but it's Lofredo, which is just my mom's maiden name.
Yeah.
She's Italian. She grew up right by a part of the Bronx is called Arthur Avenue, which is the Little Italy, the Bronx,
right,
near Fordham.
And
also,
that's, where all the good restaurants are.
I mean, it's amazing. It's really an incredible place. I grew up going almost every weekend. My grandfather actually... had a mozzarella shop, like a deli, where he made mozzarella for years. That was what he did when my mom was growing up in Arthur Avenue. So Yeah. So that's I'm Italian on that part of the family.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was obviously a politically engaged house, and your mom too. And, you know, and I take it sort of liberal with a theological base.
Yeah. Right. It was interesting. It was in a really interesting milieu because it was a very it was very news and politics aware household. We subscribed to a bunch of magazines. We watched the news. We talked about the news. My mom's family had this tradition of this very Italian tradition of arguing politics at the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that part of it. And then my dad's community justice work. And then there was this kind of, my parents had this circle of friends who were all basically people doing kind of social justice oriented work in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And largely kind of Catholic inflected, I would say.
Yeah.
And it was also this period of time in which, you know, we were living in this very working class neighborhood in the Bronx, but you know, this was in the 1980s, late 70s. I was born in 79. You know, the Bronx is in very, very dire straits. And under pretty rough conditions. And these were a lot of people very committed to kind of fighting for the neighborhoods there.
Yeah. And would you say that the neighborhood that you grew up in would you describe it as rough?
No, I wouldn't describe it as rough, actually. It felt pretty safe to me growing up.
Mm-hmm.
It was a working class outer borough neighborhood. It had been this very specific kind of New York City Bronx Irish Catholic, BIC, they call mm-hmm. them. You know, over time, white flight and things like that, there were fewer and fewer of them. It was a much more non-white neighborhood. So it was diverse racially. It was pretty working class, but not, you know, there are areas of the Bronx that had been really burned out by underinvestment, by predatory arson, basically by landlords. I mean, the whole Bronx's burning was part of what they were organizing against. And this was not that, but it was not, you know, it was not affluent. I mean, we would, you know, we would pick up my friend at the housing projects to commute together to work. School. So it was, but it felt stable. It didn't feel, in fact, you know, the funny thing I wrote in my second book, I wrote about this, the times when I felt much less safe in New York City as a kid was when I was 12 or 13. I started going down to Manhattan, particularly the Upper East Side,
mm-hmm.
To go to this magnet school. And that school was on the border of East Harlem at a time when, you know, crime was very high in the city, and we got jacked all the time.
Oh, really?
It was just a constant, you know, run your loot, run your baseball cap, take your jacket kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I didn't, as a kid in the Bronx, I didn't feel that way. We had a pretty, it was such a strange and distinct world. I don't think I appreciated it at the time, but it was just this really interesting intersection of people from all different backgrounds. I mean, Dominican, Puerto Rican, Filipino, Egyptian, Pakistani, Caribbean islands, African American, multiple generations in the Bronx, sort of white ethnic. You know, people's parents drove buses, ran delis, worked as bank tellers. You know, just this very kind of outer borough cross section melting pot New York world.
I imagine that having that as your childhood base, that really informs your worldview at an early age. It's kind of, I think it'd be hard to come out of that being xenophobic, you know, or being, you know, close-minded about different types of people.
I think it was so important and so formative for both my brother and I. I mean, I think about a few experiences. I mean, one, I remember the experience of going into people's, that's not true. A few kids actually had small houses, but almost everyone lived in apartment buildings. And there's that thing where you walk into an apartment building where you smell the regional cooking of, mm-hmm. of the building.
Yeah.
And just that feeling of curry or oxtail or, you know, Korean food, whatever it was. And, you know, noticing that, but then also you know, and you're a kid too. So you know, you get that sort of weird picky culinary thing.
Sure.
You know, that's gross. That smell, this foreign thing, but then also quickly appreciating that that's just the way different apartment smell, and that mine smells different, and that one smells different. Yeah. And people cook different things, and I eat different things when I go to this kid's house and this kid's house, and his auntie makes this thing, and so there was that, and then there was also, you know, I think another thing that was really that happened a fair amount in my upbringing, and it was a fairly like it was very diverse my elementary school, but I would find myself in fairly often in situations where like I was basically the only white kid.
Yeah.
That would happen at like certain summer camps or like some free, my mom would find like a free program and like there's like free tennis lessons in like the South Bronx tennis courts. Uh-huh. It's like, you know, I remember that experience really well. And I remember it being like a little discomforting or alienating. Mm-hmm. But also was really, I think, good for me.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's not like it made me like, it's not like I have some superior enlightenment or something. I just think that like, it's just, I guess it's, I think it's not an experience that a lot of white people have. I think that, yeah. I think that a lot of people of color will find themselves in life quite often.
Yes.
In spaces in which they are the only one in the room.
Yes. Yes.
And the subjective experience of that is pretty intense. And obviously yep. It's nowhere near as intense when it's reversed because of, you know, the way that racial hierarchy works, but just the subjective experience of noticing your own otherness in a space in which you're not the norm and I think it's a really good, important experience. And I think it's one that I wish more people had.
And I wish, you know, I mean, because I've been the only white person in a room full of black people, maybe three times in my life. And I'm 54 years old.
Right.
And that's, you know,
right. No, that's the way, I mean, American life doesn't work to create, you know, those situations.
Yeah. And I mean, I wish I had more of that. And I guess I could, you know, I wish I had had more opportunities like that to get used to that more, because I think it's important to have that perspective, like you said, you know, which is very, very Catholic, by the way, you know, the golden rule stuff, which, by the way, you just have one brother.
I do, yeah.
For some, how Catholic can these people be if they've only got two kids?
They're not that Catholic. They're actually all right. There's a real Vatican II kind of Catholicism. This is
pick and choose Catholicism.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just think because I grew up, you know, the county that I grew up in, when a black family moved there, it was in a different town, but we knew that a black family moved into our county. It was just, Jesus. You know. That's just like, and it's not that far. We're an hour from Chicago, you know,
right.
It's not that far at all. It just, it out.
But that whole region, I mean, I got to say like that entire, my wife's from Chicago and I moved to Chicago after college and, you know, New York has its own problems and there is a ton of segregation and, you know, racial disparity in the city, you know, no matter what anyone says. But the level of racial segregation in Chicago really blew me away. I was just like, wait, y'all have different parts of the city that you go like,
and they're like bisected by like
enormous highways
that were built.
Yes,
and that there
to
are,
keep
are
people.
Yeah, and there are rumored to you can flood like that was always a rumor. Those can be flooded in case of a race war.
Wow,
that was one I heard like which. I mean, of course, they're not going to be flooded, right. But still, everybody. But no, was like everybody knew. You know, that's like,
well, and that was the vibe. And I will say that, like, again, it's very hard. I think it's very hard in American life for a lot of reasons having to do with both sort of the legacy and continued practice of white supremacy and structural racism and racial heart care and all those things, all these sort of institutional factors. And then the policies that produce them, like creating sustainable and almost, I would say, like natural kind of multiracial spaces.
Yeah.
Is hard. It's hard to engineer because you're working against the grain. And I just happened to luck out into a situation in which that was the kind of just where that was the water I swam in as a child.
Yeah. You know,
was just difference, lots of people from lots of different places.
Yeah.
And I just think it was good for me. And I wish, you know, one of our challenges, I think, in America in this period is to figure out how to engineer that more.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah, because, it's hard to other people when you're sitting next to them, you know?
Yeah. And like the other thing about it too, is that, you know, Sukhetu Mehta, who's this great writer, you know, wrote a book about sort of his family's journey. He immigrated from India, and then he would later go on and write an incredible book about Mumbai. And his book, you know, he writes about his building in Queens, which was a very similar thing, right? Like, you know, Russian, Pakistani, Jamaican, like everyone. He's like, people were definitely like incredibly bigoted to each other.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
He's like, that doesn't, it's not like that goes away. Like, right, like,
right,
you know,
right.
People had tons of stereotypes. People like, yeah. It wasn't, and it's not like, you know, there's some magical fairy dust you sprinkle on human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's not like those differences went unnoted. And it's not like kids didn't say messed up stuff.
Yeah.
About,
and it's not, you know, like people weren't known as like Johnny the Greek, you mm-hmm. know, you know what I mean? Here right. comes Bill the Swede, you know.
I remember with his- some dude saying, I remember it was like a Puerto Rican friend of mine saying something about a Dominican kid that was like so racist.
Yes.
It's just like, yes. My like, heart went in my throat, but it's like, but, and not to say like any of that's okay, because it's not, and kids should not do that, and adults shouldn't do that, but the proximity of the friction of the other relationships that are happening alongside that is very different
mm-hmm.
than that stuff happening from afar or,
right,
or online
right.
or representations, right. you know?
Than sitting in Kansas and thinking you know what a Dominican person is.
That's
like.
Right. And I think, yeah. again, because, and I just don't want to, that's, it's important, I think, not to idealize, like Mehta's book has a great riff on this because he's like very real about it.
Yeah.
But I do think that, like, yeah, living with difference, living alongside difference, and being comfortable with it, and learning to kind of celebrate, and when not a celebrate, accommodate, you know, mm-hmm. That's really, it's a really important life skill.
And, yeah. And it's like, you know, you say it would be nice. It'd be, I say more than be nice. It's absolutely necessary. Like we gotta start doing that, you know, and like we gotta start doing it yesterday.
It's literally, it's the central story of American politics at this moment.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
yeah,
the
yeah.
central story of American politics at this yep. moment is a kind of divide in the country between people who are broadly comfortable with that and people who absolutely reject it. And the people who are in that first coalition, broadly comfortable, these people are not like some like, they're not like enlightened, a lot of them.
Yeah,
they're
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Some of them have like totally... fairly reactionary politics. It's like, it's not, you know, and then when you try to integrate their schools, they show up the school board meeting and lose their mind. So it's like,
yeah, yeah.
I don't want to, you know, I'm not throwing a halo on anyone, but in a broad aggregate sense, the basic accommodation to that in the general aggregate sense of we're going to be a country of difference and yeah. multiracial democracy, or we're going to be a country in which we're losing our country. Like that's the central dividing line.
Right, right. Now, when you were growing up, I mean, you grew up in this kind of, you know, very activated family. Did you always have in mind that you would be doing something with, you know, politics, current events, you know, civic issues?
I think, I don't know when I first started to say, I mean, I think, you know, when I was 7 or 8, I wanted to be a professional basketball player.
Sure, of course, but, of course.
I think I started to feel that way. Early 12, 13, you know, I remember like reading my dad's New York Review of Books.
Yeah. That's
and
man, what a jock.
Yeah. So I remember that. And I remember thinking like, that's kind of what I want to be. I want to be the kind of person who either is writing a review of the book or has written a book that is being reviewed and then has a caricature drawn of them by David Levine.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I had that. And then the other thing that happened, I would say, in college is I started doing theater. And that really like blew my mind and altered my aspirations. I think, you know, for a lot of my teenage years, I really wanted to be an actor.
Oh, wow.
Or an actor or a director or a playwright or some combination of them. And that aspiration continued through college and even after college.
Wow.
I think if things had shaken out differently, that might have been what I ended up doing.
And of course, you had your famous classmates. Didn't you direct Lin-Manuel Miranda in his first? I mean, this a lot has been made of this.
Yeah, yeah. I directed Lynn and I met when he was 12 and I was 13. He was in seventh grade. I was in eighth grade. We were cast together in a student written play called Swing Line 457, at which a dinner party where an unruly guest accidentally chucks a stapler out the window, which kills someone on the sidewalk below. And
that's pretty good for a.
Oh, I yeah. Mean, this guy, as, Rob Sosin, yeah, he was written by Rob Sosin. And Rob Sosin still works as a writer today and was like a brilliant playwright at the age of 17.
Yeah, yeah.
He wrote a play also called Neon Girly City. I still remember to this day that centers on two like 19-year-olds in Vegas, hiring a sex worker and being with her on the night that Reagan was elected, in 1980, like watching the returns come in, which was also just like incredibly profound and good.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, this is a 17-year-old playwright.
Right. I know. And so, such disparate things to glob together, you know?
Yeah. Like, so Lynn and I were in this play together and we formed this very tight bond because we both would commute on this express bus uptown. He would get off at the stop in Inwood at 207th and I go up to the Bronx. And so then we just became extremely close and we worked on a million things together. And then by senior year, he wrote his first musical, which I directed. We were super close, but there are a lot of amazing people at that school and a lot of amazing, you know, theater that we were able to make. I mean, a lot of it terrible. I mean, I'm sure if I went back and saw it, I would absolutely think it was,
but still you're doing it. I mean,
unbearable. It's unbearable. That was the most important thing.
It sounds
thing.
We were like doing it. Fertile, like just like,
oh my God, this place
to be
was
surrounded
so,
by so many creative people and people was, that continue it, to this day.
You know, it was so creatively fertile. I think one of the things, I mean, it was an amazing place in many ways. I've written about it in both my books because it was so formative for me. But, you know, one of the things I think that made it really incredible was you've got this school, it's on 94th and Park in the Upper East Side. And you've got a school that's a 5-borough school. So people come from all 5 boroughs. They test across the city. So for a whole bunch of kids, it's like home is a far way away.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just this, like, people are just hanging out around the school afterwards, like making theater or going to the newspaper. Like, cause you're no one's going to run home. It's like an hour and 15 back to, you know, Woodside or whatever.
Right.
And that, I think, was part of the incredible, creative, fertile atmosphere. Like, here we are in the city. It's 6 o'clock at night. we're in the theater. We've been here for hours, you know.
And we're a bunch of kids left to our own devices.
Very much so. It was unbelievably laissez-faire.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think arguably too much because like I think
a malpractice of some kind.
I think what ended up happening was that there's a little bit of sink or swim where it was
I see what you mean.
It was a difficult and competitive environment. And I think certain kids, and I think particularly kids that are coming from poorer neighborhoods and more difficult circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were not given the support that they needed to thrive there because it was just kind of like, all right. And I think that, you know, in retrospect, that's like, that was a real failure. But for those of us who did, you know, swim, it was magical. You know, we were like little adults. I mean, we were, you know, I thought I was 14 and like, I could just go anywhere in the city. I could walk across the park. I could take the subway to my friend's house. I could take the crosstown bus. I could hang a light and put a Leco and focus it. And I could figure out a soundboard and, but you know, like, it was just, you know, I felt like king of the world. Like there's we could do anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
And so it's interesting to me that then theater, when you say that theater changed your worldview, did that just kind of give you the notion that broadcast journalism would be in your future? I mean, because
never in a million bazillion years. I thought,
oh, really?
Never. Never.
So
never.
When you decided to start being a reporter, did you put aside the desire to?
Yeah, basically, oh, okay. That's what happened. Yeah. So it was I got out of college and moved to Chicago with my then partner, now wife, Kate. You know, she and I started dating our freshman year. We've been together ever since. So
that's nice.
23 years or something like that.
Bless you both.
Yeah, it is nice. It's been an incredible blessing in my life. And very special. I think it's a very unique thing to form your life with someone, you know, I mean, when I look back, it's like we were kind of kids when we met each other.
Yes.
And we've kind of co-formed each other, in lots of really beautiful ways and like grown together. So we moved to Chicago and I was sort of simultaneously pursuing these two tracks. I was freelancing as a journalist, trying to teach myself how to be a reporter.
Yeah.
And then I was working with a theater company where I was like trying to hustle and, you know, direct, assistant direct, you know, read mm-hmm. scripts. And
not
basically,
not so much an actor. Did you?
I was less interested. I hit a certain point where in college I acted and I was around these profoundly talented performers.
Yeah.
John Krasinski was a friend of mine in college.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's right. He went to Brown. Yeah.
Went to Brown.
I knew that. Yeah.
In fact, I cast him in something that was sort of, I think it was a really intense and wonderful experience. We did an adaptation of David Foster Wallace's Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, which I mm-hmm. had gotten obsessed with. And then I turned into a show of monologues. And then later, when we left college, John bought the rights to it and actually made a movie out of it.
Oh, wow.
That grew out of that experience that we had working on it together. And but I found myself, I liked acting a lot and I loved the rush of being on stage. Obviously, but, I just felt like I was like fine at it, but not amazing at it.
Yeah.
And I felt like, man, it's crowded out there and there's people who are amazing at this.
Yeah.
Who are like amazing and beautiful and can sing. And like, I'm like, fine, I'm fine, but I just not.
Right.
So I wanted to focus more on writing plays and directing. And maybe I think my dream would be to like be an artistic director. Mm-hmm. You know, like Oscar Eustace, who's runs the Public and had taught at Brown. And I was basically working these twin tracks. And what ended up happening was that I just started being able to make a living writing sooner.
Yeah. Yeah.
To the point where it was like, oh, okay, well, this is now segueing into like a real like I can be a writer.
Yeah. And did children come along at any point in here to sort of like force your hand one way or the other?
No, I wrote for a while and then we moved to Washington, D.C. because Kate got a clerkship for John Paul Stevens on the Supreme mm-hmm. Court. And we still did not have children. Then she worked in the Obama White House. And then by that point, you know, she was a lawyer. She was an established lawyer. She worked in the White House. I had started writing for The Nation, the Washington Bureau of The Nation, and then started mm-hmm. appearing on MSNBC as just like a commentary talking head, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
And so she didn't get pregnant with her first child since until we were like 32, 2011, when she was finishing up the Obama
White House. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So we had a good, you know, we had 10 years basically of, a solid decade of being together, 20 mm-hmm. year olds together, both kind of hustling.
Yeah.
Without that added responsibility.
Yeah. My ex-wife and I were married for 7 years before we had our first child. And we always referred to the time before our children as when we were single.
Yeah.
Meaning that like when we as a couple
were
just our, you know, our own unit and there wasn't all this extra.
I sometimes think about like, you know, sometimes you get these flashbacks to those days, like a Saturday morning, you know, when you're 26 and like you wake up with your partner at like 11 and they're like, I should go get some bagels. And
yeah,
oh, so-and-so's hanging out at whatever for brunch. Like, just,
right.
yep. knocking around.
Yeah, yeah. Like having to figure out what you're going to do with your day as opposed to having these little creatures that say, like, here's what we're doing.
Yes.
I have an agenda. Now, why did you ever consider using your sort of civic-mindedness, your you know, interest in what's happening in policy onto actually sort of being involved in making policy or kind of being, you know, more on the side of what your wife was doing?
Well, I think I used to think about running for office a fair amount.
Uh-huh.
So I did think about that. And I thought, running for office would be kind of a natural merging of these different interests, you know, like I'm a pretty natural extrovert. I like talking.
Yeah.
And
you're good at it.
I mean, I was a friend of, I was just with friends of mine from high school, some of my oldest friends, and someone was joking me. He's like, "Man, you figure out a way to talk for a living." It's like an amazing thing. I talk for a living.
But you actually, see, I do the same thing, but I don't have to know anything. You got to actually know shit.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I thought for a while about running for office. But then I think partly I didn't know the right sort of, I didn't go to law school. I thought about it for a little bit, and then Kate went and felt a little weird to also go. Like, you know, we were sort of doing different things, and she was like incredible at it and loved it immediately. And so I thought about doing that, and there's some part of it always seems attractive to me. Mm-hmm. But that was as far as it went. I didn't really think about, I really liked, I think what ended up happening is that I started getting further and further along as a writer.
Yeah.
And I had this very rare life where I didn't have anyone really telling me what to do.
Oh, wow.
Like, I had editors and I had to produce a work product, mm-hmm. but no one told me how to structure my day. I didn't really like clock in. Wow. I wasn't going to meetings.
Yeah.
And I just like really loved that freedom. Like I was just kind of free, and I had to work a lot. I worked my butt off, but I was just producing my work product every day.
Yeah.
And the thought of like going into some organization to be an intern in the policy shop of the mayor or something.
Yeah.
It just felt like I would be giving up too much freedom to do it. And so I just stayed with what I was doing because I don't know. I was like, it felt when I started making a salary as a writer, a staff writer, it just felt like I'd hit the jackpot. It's like,
yeah,
I call people up or I show up and I ask them what's going on. Then I take notes. Then I go and I kind of try to figure it out and write it up. And then I publish it under my byline. There's a direct deposit check that shows up every 2 weeks. And like, that's my life and my job. Like, this is, this is as good as it gets. Why would I do something else?
Yeah. It's a minimal amount of bullshit, which is a very, very serious concern.
Hugely. I mean, I
some like, people's careers are 80% bullshit.
I mean, dude, I've been in meetings. I mean, I even now today, like, you know, to this day, it's like I have a very crystal clear work product.
Mm-hmm.
Like everyone knows what my work product is every day.
Yeah.
And I've always loved that. I love that about writing. Like the article publishes it or it doesn't. Like my work product is transparent.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing now. You could think it's bad or it's good or somewhere in between.
Yeah.
But you can't ask like, what exactly did you do today?
Yeah. And I mean, and what else is going on behind the scenes? It's like, no, this is it. This is the product.
Yeah. I didn't have like 90 meetings where we didn't decide anything.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, my current job is incredibly, you know, demanding and punishing in many ways. Although again, let's be clear. I'm not like, you know, I'm not a hospice nurse and I'm not mining coal.
You're not a longshoreman. Yeah.
Yes. I am unbelievably privileged to do what I do. But you know, it has its own, you know, it's a pretty punishing schedule to produce every day and to start from zero and to make an hour long show every day.
Everybody's day is the same, you know, the same length.
Yeah.
And it becomes your life and it becomes your day. And unless you're some kind of like ridiculous performative Pollyanna, you start to bitch about stuff because dissatisfaction is an engine, you know? Yeah.
So it's, to me, it's, but the one thing I like about it is there's still a real minimum. I'm 42. I've made it to 42, 20 years basically in the working world. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm not having a lot of meetings where we just like, someone shows a deck and then we talk around each other and we don't make any decisions because like, there's a show. We got to make a show.
Yep.
Like
yep.
every meeting produces decisions. Those decisions are then executed. And then every day, no matter how anyone's feeling or what has gone on, at 8 p.m. on the dot, a green light comes up on the camera and beams us out to millions of homes across the country live.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
it also, you can't be precious about it.
No, you cannot. You can't, and you can't miss a deadline, and you can't rewrite something 40 times, and you can't say, ugh, this isn't good enough. Like, you got to ship the product.
Yeah. And also, I imagine that sort of minimizes competition among colleagues too, I would think too, that where it's not like, or does it?
Yeah. I mean, competition doesn't even enter into the picture in some ways because I find the effort to make the thing so totalizing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there's very little space.
Yeah.
You know,
to be even aware of what's going on.
People will say sometimes it's like, oh, like what do you and Lawrence talk about? Are you, and it's like, we just spend every second from the time we wake up, like making a show every day.
Yeah.
It's
there's
not a lot of water cooler. I mean, even before COVID, like it's not a lot of like futzing around and like, you know, you get up, you start reading the news and you just walk through the process of the meetings to make the show that night.
Yeah. And also that kind of autonomy and sort of direct line between your efforts and its result. Like, holy shit, are you absolutely wrong for politics now? You know what I mean?
I mean, I think, I think that's right. I think it's probably spoiled me for that.
Yeah, because my younger brother is a school teacher in Illinois, and he ran for Congress because he took a group of students to see what was going to be Hillary Clinton's inauguration. And then, they had to see Trump's inauguration. And he said, they were sophomores in high school, I think. Just kids crying because of the vibe. Yep. And then he said, then the 180 the next day of the Women's March he said that it just inspired him. And he ran for office, actually, in Lauren Underwood's district. I just a little glimpse into that. And I had a hunch this is the way it is, but all you do is ask for money.
Yeah.
That's, like when you think like somebody, that's what kills me about people that the chicanery that goes on to keep people in office in a congressional seat in Indiana or something is their life is asking for money.
They dial for dollars. It's
When's the fun happen?
Yeah. And you also, you have to get so disciplined about that. And you have to, it's really I did a podcast with my brother about this actually, because he's a he's a political organizer, campaign manager. And I have a podcast called Why Is This Happening? And one of them, I just interviewed him about like, okay, like what's it like to run for office? Like walk me through the steps. Like day one, like what do we do? Like he just, it's the whole hour is just him just being like, well, first you get the signatures and then. And he talks about that, you know, the benchmarks, the lists, how you get the list, and the crazy psychological cat and mouse back and forth game between the finance director and the candidate who never wants to do it and has to be like induced and hectored and chased around. And like, it's like you can get some dinner if you do 2 hours of call time or like, we'll let you do something fun. Like, and the whole thing is just a real, real bummer.
Yeah. No, it does not sound fun at all. And just because I'm a political loudmouth on Twitter, people are like, you should run for office. And I'm like, no fucking way. It's like, make my life a one long PTA meeting. No, thank you. You know.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places?
Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Well, how do you transition from writer to on-camera personality? Who's the first one that's like, son, you got to get on TV?
Well, I got on, you know, we had this great PR person at The Nation named Ben Mosqueda, who still does PR, and he was, you know, doing what PR people at print magazines do, was trying to hustle you onto TV. I went on to C-SPAN Washington Journal to talk about an article I wrote, like on a Sunday morning at like, you know, 8 a.m. with the call-in show. I'll never forget, someone called in apropos of literally nothing in the article to suggest that maybe the solution to our garbage problem was to throw the garbage in volcanoes.
Yes, and Baba Booey to you too.
I was just like,
yeah,
oof. That's pretty far outside my area of expertise. Actually, that clip is still on YouTube.
It's not far off from you know, shooting a nuclear missile at a hurricane.
Exactly.
You know?
No, that was the first. I think I told that story literally to my staff the day that story came out. And then from there, I think some producers at MSNBC saw that clip and then invited me to be on the, I was on Oberman. In fact, the first time I was on Oberman was when the first night that Rachel Maddow guest hosted for Oberman. And then, you know, I think basically what happened is, the thing I would say, I would be curious what you think about this since this is what you do for a living too. Like, there's a few different ways to think about like the ability to talk on television. So basically the way I think about it is some people are real naturals at it.
Yeah.
Like some people we have on and I'm like, whoa. And I think I was a natural at it. Like I talk a lot. I like to talk. I was natural at it. The second thing I'll say is like basically.
You also, if I may say, you talk in a very writerly way.
Huh, like, that's interesting.
You do. Yeah. You talk in a very writerly way and in like a much more sort of intricately constructed sentences than most people exchange ideas with.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I never thought of it quite in those terms, but I think that there's a certain fluidity that was natural to me.
Yeah.
And so I think they, you know, I have this experience too. We'll try someone out and sometimes it's like, they were fine. And sometimes like, oof, that was terrible. And sometimes whoa, book that person again. So I think that was part of it. The second thing I would say is basically anyone can get good at it. It is not neurosurgery. And with enough practice, you know, and you see this sometimes with athletes who are signed to be TV commentators because of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning, it's like, oh my God. Because they're just like, don't have a natural affinity. But you know what? A year later, they're perfectly good.
They're fine. Yep.
And the reason is basically, you know, aside from the question of like, you know, human disability or whatever, but anyone can talk. Like, anyone can communicate. We all do in different ways. So, and then there's like the third step, which is like mastery.
Yeah.
And there's just a really interesting learning curve. This is true for teleprompter too, where, you know, some people are good at it naturally. Some people are struggle with it naturally. Anyone can get pretty good. And then being masterful at it is extremely hard.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And I think the masterful level is you can do it or you can't. Like, you either got it in you or you can't. I think.
I totally agree. That's what I mean. Yeah. Like that last 20%.
Yeah.
Like that you could get anyone to the 80%.
That's, but,
same but the thing. The last 20%, I think there's some combination of discipline, technique, and then just like natural talent that comes together.
It's like the difference between actors and movie stars. Like, there are just movie stars that just, and when you meet them, it's just like, oh, yeah, that person is
magnetic. Like,
just has magnets that draw your eyes to them, and they're just, you know, you want to see them just talk and move around.
Well, I think this is true of you and Conan, and I think it's true of a bunch of people, but the hardest thing to be to me, the hardest thing about television, the master of this, the two people I think about all the time who are kind of like at the top of this are Oprah and Letterman, particularly mm-hmm. late stage Letterman and Oprah now, which is like your body is processing adrenaline and fight or flight stuff in all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
That you can consciously control a little bit by focusing on breath, but is largely subconscious.
Yeah.
And people that achieve a certain level of mastery, and this is true of you and Conan too, like get to a level where all of that chemical stuff basically isn't happening.
Yeah.
And your breath and your sympathetic nervous system is yeah. functioning as if you were talking to a person.
Yeah.
And that stuff is deep below your conscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a huge difference when you're listening to a person. You may not be able to sort of consciously realize the difference between a person who's operating at that level, but who's not.
Yeah.
But when you're in the presence, particularly in broadcast, of someone like that, Martha Stewart's another example.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, holy crap. Like yeah. you're just like, and getting to that level is extremely difficult.
Yeah. Just as a quick anecdote, I was a guest on a short-lived Will Arnett sitcom in which Margot Martindale played his mother. And at the it's very common on a multi-camera sitcom that all the cast gets into the makeup room as usually the star is getting made up, mm-hmm. and you do a run through. Mm-hmm. Or just and everybody just does a top speed level of all the recited lines. Margot Martindale was sitting on a chair and saying her lines at triple speed. It was like you just felt
killing.
Like yeah, just everything she said was like I didn't even like I forgot my lines because I was yeah. just watching her yeah. do this. And it's yeah. a fucking sitcom. It's not yeah. you yeah. know. It's just the those people are incredible. Now, I do want to ask, because you went from being, you know, socially aware young guy in a very socially aware family, in a diverse background, writer, start getting on TV. Now you have a TV show.
I do.
And you got to get ratings. And you got to, you know, there is an aspect of your show that's show business, because it's on sure television.
So true.
Yeah.
It's funny.
And how do you handle that? Like,
well, it's a great question. The answer is that when I first had a morning weekend show that was very successful, mm-hmm. that was successful, I think partly because it was massively format breaking, but also there was no ratings competition really at the time. So it was able to flourish. Then I went to primetime April 1st, 2013. And basically the show immediately tanked mm-hmm. ratings wise. And it absolutely destroyed my psyche.
Yeah.
It was the most difficult psychological period of my life, which again,
there's nothing like having a country reject you.
Yeah. I mean, again, know? World's smallest violin, right? But
right,
but,
right.
But my, and you know what? You know what I would, this is honest to God. I listened. One of the key things that got me through that period was Conan's Marin interviews.
Oh, wow.
Because he talks about that experience.
Yeah.
In them. And I just found it so comforting and also relatable.
Mm-hmm.
Of just that feeling of like, yeah, I'm being rejected and I'm failing. I'm yeah. failing publicly. And there was something also about the fact that he came through it that made me feel like I'm not going to be consigned to like the dustbin of history.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately what I would say about ratings is that I've used this metaphor before, but I think when you get a TV show, you think that you're getting the keys to a sports car
mm-hmm.
and you're just going to go and drive where you want.
Mm-hmm.
And what you realize is that you just got a sailboat.
Yeah.
And yeah. you can't just, it has no power under it, its own.
Yeah.
It only goes somewhere because the wind, and the wind is audience attention.
Yeah.
And if you can't find where the audience attention is blowing and then channel the audience attention and tack around the audience attention, to move the show and the boat where you want it to go, you can't be successful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some people who don't care where the boat goes.
Yeah.
And so one thing to do is just chase audience attention.
Yeah.
And there are ways to do that that are successful. In my case, I really care where the boat goes.
Yeah.
But I can't make it go there by myself. And I sure as hell cannot steer into the wind. I can't mm-hmm. say, hey, America, here's a thing you're not paying any attention to.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make you pay attention.
Yep.
I could pick my spots and sometimes do that.
Yeah. And you do. I've seen yeah. it before. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm now, again, I'm a sufficiently accomplished, you know, sailor now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That I can do that. But that was all very difficult learning. And, you know, we spent the first 2 or 3 years where the broader context was that interest in political news had fallen off a cliff. Barack Obama won a second term.
Mm-hmm.
That story was kind of over. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. it wasn't over. He was still the president, but it was like,
I know what you mean.
A certain narrative tension had left the story.
Yep. Yep.
And in the absence of that narrative tension, what you saw across all political media was, you know, stuff just fell off the table.
Yeah.
And so that was the context we were in, and it was brutal. And we were, you know, we were not rating very well. I was constantly having stories written about how I was going to get canceled, and
yeah, yeah.
And they were talking to this person or that person. It's just totally messing my head. It's
yeah,
absolutely brutal.
And are there executives throwing all kinds of unhelpful suggestions at you?
Of course.
Yes. 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 Yes.
Of course, you're getting noted to death. Yeah. And it's not even like it's like you want them to, you know, go away, but it's also like, it's not really working. It's like,
yeah.
You know, and it was, I'm still genuinely like psychically scarred from that period.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like for real. It really, but we came through it. We sort of, I honestly think, to be honest, the only reason I survived that period, two reasons. One is, we kind of became a to-do list item that never got crossed off.
Yeah.
You know, that those things that are on your to-do list that like you look up, and you're like, holy shit, that's been there 5 years. Like,
yeah.
It's like there was always some post-it somewhere, like replace Chris Hayes at
yep.
PM.
I know. I've been there.
It never quite got.
Yeah.
It never got executed. And then I think the other thing, honestly, was that we were always, I think, myself and our staff, my executive producer, Dennis Horgan, who deserves a huge amount of credit, I think, for our survival, were everyone knew how hard we were working,
mm-hmm.
how much we wanted it to work, and how generally like decent we were as colleagues to work with. Like,
yeah.
People did not have it out for us.
Right.
They weren't like, oh, that asshole.
Right, you know? Right.
I mean, some people had it out for us because they wanted to take over the slot.
Yes.
And that's just normal. That's just, you know.
Normal Machiavellian bullshit.
Yeah, that's just like, yeah, that's life. You know, that's what it is. But I think the fact that it was clear to everyone that that no one was working harder at it or trying to figure it out more than we were.
Yeah.
That combined with time. And then honestly, the context just changed, you know, and then all of a sudden the show became quite successful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think a huge part of that was luck, a combination of luck, context. And I think we talk about that learning curve was there was some level of performative comfort that I achieved.
Yeah.
That probably helped.
Yeah. No, it takes a while to learn how to be on TV. You know,
yes.
Lorne Michaels, who, whatever you want to say about him, is an amazing font of aphorisms. And one of his is, the longer you're on TV, the longer you're on TV.
Absolutely.
And it is true. It's just, you get on there and nobody goes, it's like you say, they don't go to the trouble of taking you off because, well, he's already there and then, you know, they're doing all right. And, you know, okay, whatever, leave him there.
And because you get, you get better and people get, you know, TV functions, particularly TV personality relationships,
mm-hmm.
they're operating. I mean, I have a whole riff on this that I'll spare you, but like the short version is that We evolved as hunter-gatherers on the savannah, in which we produced extremely powerful facial recognition as a means of telling who our kin are.
Yes, yes, not and, killing each other.
And that basically, like, that, like, the one of the oldest pieces of our brain circuitry is functioning
when
we see a person, particularly night in, night out. It's like, oh, that's kin. Like, they'll share food with me. I'll share food with them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a powerful thing. That's a tough thing to break.
Yeah. Yeah, biological imprinting.
Yes.
The secret to TV success. Well, I got to get you out of here because you got a show to do. So just to kind of wrap up, you know, this podcast, we like to kind of have people say, like, you know, you started out, you know, your life is a very successful, interesting life of adjusted expectations. and I wonder, like, what has that taught you? And I mean, and what from that arc do you feel like sharing because people always ask when you're doing good, they say, how do you do it? You know, they always want advice. So,
I mean, honestly, the honest answer is that, like, an enormous amount of privilege and luck.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's just that's the truth.
Yeah.
I think the other two things I would say are, I think that it has borne me pretty intense rewards to be a person who is generally an affable and polite, kind person.
Yeah.
It's not to say I don't get angry. I don't, you know, whatever. Yeah. But I think generally, like, on the how is he an asshole spectrum, I'm not really.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, because there's a lot of people who are.
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. And also, that's the way the wind blows when you're on TV and you get surrounded by people that want to make things happen for you. If you don't work against it, you will become a dick.
Yeah. Yes. No. Oh my God. It's like, television success is like someone running an experiment to see if they can turn you into a psychopath.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Here, let's just, like, have lots of strangers have opinions about you
and make
you simultaneously feel, like, omnipotent and desperately needy.
And
like,
garbage.
What if we combine, like, unceasing neediness with enormous ego and just pump them into your brain? Like, what will happen? And the answer is, you'll become a psychopath. So
you become a lunatic. Yeah.
So I think that not being a psycho, and then the last thing I would say is that I will say this about, I think, like, you know, to quote Shakespeare, like, to thine own self be true.
Yeah.
It was hard at times and I felt really pulled at times, but I never gave up on who I am. I am who I am. I believe in what I believe in. I say what I say. I think I've gotten better at, like, you know, certain broadcasting technique things, but I never was like, well, whatever, what do you want me to be?
Yeah.
And I'm so happy that I didn't, because it felt tempting to do that at times.
Yeah. And I've never felt that people do that. I mean, it's a different side of television, but I've never felt that people that I've never encountered a person that did that, who said, let me be who you want me to be, ever ends up
happy. Right. Yes.
They always end up in absolute fucking misery. Absolute misery. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And there are some people who get successful that way. It's not that that is a way that
that's what I mean.
It can work.
Yeah.
Like, it can absolutely work.
Absolutely.
But it takes a psychic toll for sure.
Yeah. But you basically have just given yourself to, I call it the commodification of the self.
Yeah.
Like, you take the deepest part of you, and whether you know it or not, you're giving it to somebody to be printed on t-shirts.
Yep.
And that fucks you up, you know? So don't do that, kids.
Don't do that, kids.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you so much for
this. This was a really, really incredible conversation. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Sure. I was happy to, and I was excited that you said yes. So go give him hell tonight.
I will.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks, Chris. And thank all of you for listening to this episode of The Three Questions. And we'll be back next week.
Big love for you.
The
3 Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review the 3 Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts. Can't you tell my love's a growing?
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.